Hi there. This is WCOM, Carrboro, Chapel Hill, 103.5 on FM dial. Welcome. This is another Touchstones. We are your show that deals with religious experience. And pardon me for spacing out a little bit. I am your host, Paul Nagy, and today we have two guests who are going to talk to us about the process, the pilgrimage, the spiritual journey of living through, surviving, and thriving through cancer. One is our local person, Mary Phyllis Horn, who does shamanic healing work and psychological work in soul retrieval, which she'll talk to us another time on. And the other person comes from us from New York, where she is down here promoting her book. And I will activate their microphones presently. Now, you should be able to talk, Pooja. Pooja, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, I'm Pooja Thompson. I'm originally from Scotland, but I've lived in the States for a long time in New Paltz, New York. And when I was diagnosed with cancer, I was surprised at how vulnerable I had become. And I couldn't find a comprehensive, inclusive, inspiring book. So after the journey, I was encouraged to write this book. So that's why I'm down in Raleigh. It's called Aftershock, From Cancer Diagnosis to Healing. It's a step-by-step guide to help you navigate your way.
And I love that Scottish accent. Mary Phyllis, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and your shamanic path?
Well, I originally was a high school choral music teacher. I was originally a high school choral music teacher, and during that time I kept feeling the pull towards shamanism, and I didn't really set on it until I finally left music teaching after 31 years of teaching, and I went into transpersonal psychology in Boulder, Colorado, and it's there that I had a very profound mystical experience that said beyond a shadow of doubt I needed to get into shamanic work. And within a month's time, I'd taken the basic workshop from Michael Harner, and it felt like old home week. I knew it was what I had been looking for all that time.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, and I'm always assuming the people that know, Michael Harner is an anthropologist.
Yes.
Who did a great deal of work towards making the shamanic spiritual path available to anyone who was so called. And yes. It is a valid spiritual call. And there are many people who practice it in varying degrees. Mm-hmm. This show, Pooja, is specifically on religious experience. So one of the things, I guess it might make sense to look at as and all, part of the motivations for you writing your book would be your own, how your own self was challenged with your diagnosis. And the experience that you went through with the cancer treatment. It was breast cancer?
It was breast cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it certainly was a challenge because I was a health professional, and I thought I'd done all the right things, and still I was diagnosed. And so it does bring up questions of guilt. How come me? And I have to acknowledge that perhaps there were some things that I was not doing quotes right in my life. On the other hand, there are so many multiple causes for cancer that one of the messages of my book is don't blame yourself for having cancer. There's all sorts of people who do nothing right that get off scot-free, while some people who do organic food and do exercise and, they may be genetic, it may be environmental reasons with the toxicity. And certainly I called on my spiritual resources to help me through, and I'll be happy to say more about that.
So did you have a religious background at all? As a health professional, were you more science-oriented?
No, I actually was being trained originally as a teacher and a group and community worker. And in Scotland, I worked for the youth department of the Church of Scotland at one point. So by origin, I was a Scottish Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. However, I also have gone to India and studied with a teacher, Rajneesh. And my name, Pooja, was a meditation name that was given to me. And it means celebration or worship or ceremony.
Yes, I that's how I understand Pooja. So every time I hear your name, I think of ringing a bell in front of an altar and lighting a candle.
Uh-huh.
And chanting, yeah. Mary Phyllis, you mentioned your own distinct call to the shamanism. Do you want to say a little more about what that actually was like?
Well, it was actually the ability to send a spirit of a person who died in a car accident and to send her off to the light. I just thought, you know, and send her off to the light. And I thought, whoa, you know, and she was willing. So I thought, maybe I need to find out more about this for those who are not so willing, you know, and I work with. And that's what some of the work that I do in shamanically is to help a person clear their aura and with the use of Archangel Michael to send them off to the light.
And in terms of clearing their aura, this might be like senses of regret, guilt, or shame that they may have that they've picked up from their life or from other people. Is that what you mean?
It's that. It's also unwanted or unneeded connections to other people. What, in shamanic terms, somebody else's part of their soul is connected to that person. And each person's soul is unique to them. And that soul is bright white light. It's the connection to the God force. But if it is on somebody else, it shows up as a block in the dark. It could even be Jesus's or Buddha's soul on you, and it still would show up dark because it wasn't yours. You know, I mean, that's very rough analysis.
So would you say that it's sort of like emotional attachments? You know, like, you know, when you first fall in love and it doesn't work out, and you pine and you feel terrible, you have a sense of homesickness. These are extreme examples of attachment that we feel at different. But would you say then that the soul that you're feeling, that these are kinds of attachments, conscious and unconscious, that people have towards other people or other people have towards them?
Yeah, either way. And it's almost like there's an invisible cord that is sent out from one person to the other. And if a part of the soul, like I've heard people say, like a mother will say, I gave my son my heart and look what he's doing to me now. And it's because she gave part of herself on him that that part of herself is speaking in that child's ear all the time. And if you have somebody talking in your ear 24/7, you get pretty irritated. So yeah. what part of what we do is to send that off to that person's higher spiritual.
So it's a sort of loving severance of unnecessary attachments.
And I've seen people who have problems with a parent or with a child, and this clearing is done, immediately there's an ease. Somehow they find it easier to communicate without that irritation.
And probably goes both ways, right? It would go,
yes
it would because. So this type of stuff then is probably done unconsciously for the most part.
Yes.
These kinds of attachments that you're talking about.
And just like Pooja was saying, don't blame yourself for cancer. In this case, if you have somebody else's soul part on you or they on you, don't blame yourself. That's an unconscious thing. It's part of our growing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I would think that from what you're saying, we're both working towards health in the sense of wholeness.
Yes.
And so illness can manifest first in spirit and then in the emotions, and then it can manifest physically. And I found that I saw my journey towards health as a pilgrimage. A pilgrimage is an inner journey within an outer journey. And so people do go to healing wells or to special people like John of God or to Lourdes in France or to other healing places. I began to see, I had an aha moment that I said, going to my doctor's offices is like going to a sacred port of call on my journey towards health. And it was to bring health to my body, but also it was to bring health to my spirit and to my emotions. And I discovered that, or I knew from the mind-body connection, that you can use your mind to bring healing to the body. You can use your emotions to bring healing yes. to the body. You can use and tap into spirit to bring healing to your body. So,
and if we believe the Hatha yogis, we can bring we can the body can bring health and wholeness to the spirit.
Yes,
it's in all directions.
In all directions, yeah. The apparently we have somebody outside that's honking seriously.
It's a truck backing yes. up, not wanting to hurt anybody.
Okay,
or hit anybody.
The this is when you're at community radio here, we're right on the street, everybody. So yeah. we hear what's going on outside in Carrboro. In terms of healing, this was actually mentioned last week, Phyllis. We had people here who were ghost hunters last week. And one story I began to tell, which your story reminded me of, is when I was a minister in Oklahoma. There was a member of the congregation had killed himself, and it was not an expected suicide. This guy was extremely successful and in the peak of his on the up thrust of his career. He was still in his 30s, and he died, and he was very successful, in his profession. And the community was horrified, and not just the church community, but the his work community. So we had a big crowd in this church, and we had to address the issue of the suicide. Now, for me, this was my first, big charged funeral. I'd done a number of smaller funerals where the people had passed on and were, an expected degree. This one wasn't. And I felt afterwards I had a sense of an emotional sense that the guy who had killed himself felt a great deal of regret. It was sort of like he was surprised that so many people were so openly mourning him, and he felt ashamed and regret. And myself, in terms of my own experience of this, was I thought, well, this is either me having these feelings because this is how I'm feeling, or I'm having these feelings because this guy feels this way. It could be either way. So I said, well, if it's you, then you should go to the light. And I said, go to the light. There's nothing more you can do here but go away and go in mm-hmm. peace. So I just said that over and over again, sort of almost like a chant. And it soothed me. as I said to ministerial director, I have to remember I was from a very liberal congregation and talking to ghosts was somewhat frowned upon. But they said, well, this was a form of self-talk. It worked for me. And maybe it worked for him. I mean, I don't need to have a claim that it worked for him, from this point of view. But it was the way I was experiencing, the way I was being in touch with the intensity of that whole experience. And suicides often are that way in the sense that they do leave incredible psychological wounds, impressions, as it were, on who we are, and that may or may never heal. They may leave a permanent emotional attitude or scar or whatever you want to call it.
Yes, because the survivors are always saying, if I had only done this or if I'd only recognized this, there was all that if only type of thing.
Yeah.
I think there's a similar intensity of feeling when one is diagnosed with cancer because there is so much fear culturally yeah. around cancer as there is for suicide, how to deal with this.
Yeah, actually, it's the big, it was the C word. Nobody wants to hear it. And it was almost always seen as you're going to be mutilated, maimed, and probably die.
Yeah.
Was the immediate things that come to mind and suffered terribly with the chemo. Obviously you wrote this book Aftershock primarily as a way of telling people what to expect and for people who have the diagnosis or to help people who know people who are going through it.
Absolutely, because It's to empower people to know that it's your body and it's your decision about the body. As a mentally competent adult, when you sign the papers, it's really important that you know what you're signing for any treatment, because it's not then the doctor's responsibility, it's your responsibility. And so I encourage people to prepare well for doctor's visits, to really know the questions they want to ask. Doctors are very busy people.
Give us a sense of how you would go about doing that, because a lot of people are afraid of doctors and don't know what they mean when they start throwing those medical terms at them.
Yeah, I would suggest that you always have someone with you as an extra set of ears that can support you, that you prepare well in advance, you have your personal team in place, and then you go to the doctor's visits and you write down your questions. And in the book I have many, many suggestions of the questions to ask, and about what is my diagnosis, what are your recommendations, what are the possible treatments, what if I don't do anything, all sorts of questions. And then you select that and you make sure you ask them, and that if you find a doctor who isn't willing to answer your questions, that may not be the best person for you. I also suggest that it's important to get a second opinion, because many people are, again, because doctors have been on a pedestal in the past, say, oh, I don't want to hurt my doctor's feelings. This question came up the other day, but I really would like to get a second opinion. And I suggest that you get a second opinion from somebody who's trained in a different school, so you have another set of perspectives coming in this, and that you also look at other ways, other modalities to support, and use your intuition as well. It's really, do your research, get friends to help you with the internet if you're not good at that.
I was also going to say that it also might make sense to if you don't have a friend who can act this way for you, is to look for someone who can help you, a social worker, a therapist, or someone who may know something about the process and who you can talk to as a way of reflecting on those questions, on the information you're getting from the doctor.
Absolutely.
And that kind of stuff. Find many people to talk to. And I guess support groups work for that too, right?
Support groups work for that. Many hospitals or groups have patient navigators that will go with you if you don't have someone personally. I had a patient navigator go with me and she was well-versed in the terminology. I could say, what does that mean, if I didn't understand? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to ask the doctor to slow down, please repeat that, or I don't understand. So that if you prepare well, it puts you in the position of having more confidence than if you just go in there not knowing anything about what's going to happen. So
yeah. Now we're just doing a switching terminologies here. We're talking medical terminology and a sort of psychological terminology about how to feel and manage your emotions and manage your fear and your anxiety through going through this process of life. And part of the process of living is having disease. If it isn't cancer, it's something else. There's different ways that we have to manage our diseases. And we talk in the shamanic mode, we're talking also a way of managing disease, managing our feelings. And we use this term soul. And, I was kidding with Mary Phyllis earlier and saying, I'm a scientist. That's soul word. That's a religious term, and I'm not religious. Therefore, I don't have a soul. and obviously, we sort of short circuited that earlier before when we were talking about it as that part of the experience of the soul is recognizing your emotions and your feelings, your thoughts about stuff. But Mary Phyllis, can you be a little? I want you to go back to that, to your definition of soul, and I'll probably want to bring in a few other versions of it later.
Okay.
But yeah, go back to your core definition of what you mean by soul, because most of us don't necessarily think that we have souls. We're sort of we walk away from that language after Sunday morning, as it were.
Well, the soul in the shamanic terms is not the same as spirit. And if you think of the Greek, the psyche is the soul, psyche. That's what part of psychology came from, the study of the soul. And the Greeks also call the spirit pneuma. So it's a different thing.
Yeah, pneuma is the breath, and it's the universal spirit. Yeah.
Yes.
And the soul then is like, if the universal breath were an ocean, the soul is the boat that's floating on the ocean.
The soul is the drop of water in the ocean.
Is the drop of water in the ocean. Okay,
and
so explain that a little more. So even though you're in the ocean, you're maintaining your droppedness.
Yes. The soul is our uniqueness from God, whether you call it God, spirit, Allah, or whoever you call the divine creator. The soul is unique to each of us. We are the spark of the divine. And if you think of in a lot of scriptures that where God in the beginning split itself apart to start creation, and everything that split off is our soul, those each of our souls. And we are discovering creation and we are winding our way back to God. But basically, in shamanic terms, the soul is our uniqueness. It is what makes us, makes me, makes you, makes everybody themselves. And our own soul cannot take the place of anyone else's.
Well, I do conceptualize it a little differently. And obviously these things are poetry just to a degree. But like one of the ways that I would see it is when I say the soul is our uniqueness, usually what I say is that the spirit in my soul is what is unique.
Well, the soul carries a spirit.
Yeah.
The soul can carry our ego, can carry our personality, can carry our traits, it can carry the spirit, but it still is unique. And not even general spirit, if somebody is missing part of their soul, you can bring in spiritual healing, but it's kind of like bringing a blood transfusion to somebody. If they can't renew their own blood from their own bone marrow, then after a while, that blood transfusion dies away, and they have to have another one. So only our own soul can take ourselves. It's your awareness, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean,
consciousness,
yeah.
An essence. I like the word essence.
Yes.
The essence of a person.
Yes.
And so, unfortunately, we have a number of post-structuralist people who have been taught that essence is a bad word, you see. I mean, unfortunately, this is a prejudice for people who have been educated in the last 20 years in postmodernism. Essence is a word that everybody's anti-essentialism. Essentialism is a form of colonial oppression. So I'm just giving you a hard time about the
right.
word essence.
Well, let's
I know
terms
you
of
like
of energy.
The word. Yes.
Let's
okay.
think in terms of
yes.
energy, because I think energetically, if we don't, we're not just dense bone and
yes,
we have life force flowing through us, and we can
yes.
plug into circuit or plug into the universal oneness, and from that we can replenish our strength. And so in some ways, disease is a disconnect from that source or a disconnect from the health of the whole.
Yeah, and if we go back to, you know, dis-ease, you know,
yes.
to the view of, you know, ease is health and dis-ease is when we are, when things aren't healthy. So when do you know you're not healthy? Well, it hurts. You know, I don't feel good, you know. So obvious, that's the disease of the thing. But.
And Dr. Batch, who was the Batch flower essences, always used to say disease is already part of the cure. Because if you didn't know you were sick, you wouldn't be doing anything about it. So
yeah.
It's the body's
mm-hmm.
way of already initiating mm-hmm. Help and cure.
And but we also... We have to caution people here, as we know with our own... things is that there are many diseases or symptoms of diseases that we don't feel. Like often all the early stages of colon cancer are probably asymptomatic. You're not going to see anything that's going to tell you. You're not going to feel mm-hmm. pains. you're not going to think. And so the only way that you could find out that you're diseased in these particular cases, high blood pressure is another great thing. People don't necessarily know that they're suffering from high blood pressure until they've had a stroke, and then it's sort of the damage has been seriously done, and it takes a lot of things. So there are diseases out there that require that you visit a doctor once in a while.
Well, I think it also requires a consciousness about health and a willingness to create your own wellness program in a preventative way before you get sick to the extreme level.
Yeah, well, let's address some of that, because, you know, part of it is, yes, we need to address a good health wellness program, but also, you know, if it, you know, somehow didn't work, you know, you still get sick, you know.
Well, basically, life is a mystery, mm-hmm. and, you know, it boils down to the fact that we do what we can do, and we can become more and more conscious of the things that we can do. But we will always have blind spots. And life is a mystery also as to why certain things happen here or there, why you meet this person, not that person, why. Mm-hmm. But the body has a kind of, it's not by accident that some people have heart disease and other people have back diseases. There's a correlation between some of diseases of rigidity, say, and certain diseases and heart, and the language tells us that we've known right from the start.
So he's hard-hearted,
or she's a pain in the neck, or you know, we correlate.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is this, also in terms of like the term you used, our own blind spots we might have. That part of what you're talking about, Mary Phyllis, with the soul retrieval, is that we all naturally have little blind spots.
Yes.
Little parts of ourselves that we have given away or have had taken away or have blocked from ourselves because of our life experiences. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with you at one level, the level that the idea is to know, you know, wholly who you are in the mm-hmm. sense of reclaiming your own natural wholeness. And, you know, and also in terms of, loving, you know, well, loving is a kind of weird word in English, because we got one word that covers both the most sublime, divine love, unattached, supernal beauty, almost unimaginable love. And then we also have love as jealousy and attachment, and this is what I want, love is a bargain, you know, I'll love you if you love me, which is, you know, most people might start questioning how much that is actually love and not something else. But you have this range of experience when you're using the same word. And you want to say something?
No, it was the
What I wanted to move towards was in terms of looking at your work as in the soul reestablishment of the health and the wholeness and the well-being of the soul. You're attempting to get a person to know who they are in their own uniqueness. You know,
yes.
And of course, you're using uniqueness in a kind of interesting way, because what it is it's, partly the way I see the soul is it's your temporary vessel that you have while you're alive here in this world. You know, it's why you're alive. You know, it dissolves. Well, what doesn't dissolve is your soul. You know, what continues is this uniqueness of who you are, which is...
Yes.
And the reason it doesn't dissolve is because it's divine. Now, there is arguments, both in Christianity and other places. Even Karl Barth, who's a well-known in Scotland theologian, felt that the soul did not survive if it did not have a certain degree of spiritual self-culture. In other words, real eternal damnation was that when you died, if you didn't develop your religious sense as alive, when you died, you just died. And that was hell, that your immortality, your own conscious integration to your own immortality, to your own ever living this divine nature, the thing that gets you into heaven and gets you to sort of enjoy heaven, that you have to find it while you're alive and recognize that that's who you are for you actually to survive death. I mean, that was one view of heaven, which actually it was interesting is that such a conservative theologian carried this view, which is not normative in most Christian sects. Mary Phyllis?
Well, I think a lot has to do with what word you put to it. And if you think of the uniqueness is connected to the divine, and if you want to call that spirit, you can do that. You know, I call it soul in shamanic terms, because when I do a soul retrieval for somebody, I see a little image of them there. And that little image also has a sense about it, him or her, that is very much like my client in many ways. It's sometimes the soul part will say, well, I didn't even know I was away. And then I have Archangel Michael or one of my angels come in there to work with them. And they understand that. And when the part comes back to the person, they feel more alive. They feel more alert. All of a sudden, some people said, this soul part talked to me the whole way home. You know, and I know it was the soul part because she was telling me things and reminding me of things that I never told you, Mary Phyllis. Okay? And so... And in this way, they become more whole. Where one time I had three clients came to me in a row, it seemed like, over a two-week span. All of them very shy. And they were dressed to the nines. And they came in. They were very pleasant. They were very pleasant to be with. And one of them, the soul part that came back, gave the person a love for everybody. Everyone she saw, she loved. And she forgot her shyness. The man who got the soul part back all of a sudden was curious about everybody. And he said, everybody looks different. I wonder if their personality is different. So he forgot his shyness. And then another person who was very shy, the soul part that came back helped her to know she was okay within herself. And she didn't care if she talked to someone or didn't talk to someone. She knew she was okay within herself. And it was just so dramatic, so immediate. And I've even done soul retrievals for dogs and cats. And there's an immediate change with them, too. It seems like there's an essence there that comes in. So I'm wondering if it might be a case of semantics, what one person calls spirit, another person says soul, yeah. Another person calls personality, whatever.
Yeah, I do agree that I'm sure that it is a matter of semantics.
Yeah.
And there's a great deal of confusion on that situation. But in some ways, I like to call attention to that confusion in the show as a way of saying that, you know, things aren't as necessarily as simple as we would like to make them. Or if you do have a simple system that works for you, you have to realize that not everybody else is necessarily understands it quite exactly the same way. And it's not but usually if you get down functionally, like the way you've just talked, where you start seeing how functionally things work, you can start seeing where the similarities are. The similarities come out in the sense of experience in the thing that thinks. So even somebody who says, look, I don't have a soul, can say, well, yeah, but I do have feelings, and you're talking about feelings, and I can understand that, you know.
But they're aware of themselves, they're aware of life. And even people who are in a coma have a sense of soul there. Even people who are psychotic in some way, they're still aware of what their experience is.
Sure.
And that's part that is part of the soul. It's almost undefinable.
Yeah,
this is a bit, I mean, even God is undefinable.
Yes.
Let's hope so.
I can tie myself up in knots with semantics and confuse myself. So I think, and I too was ordained as a minister of healing, and we honor all the many pathways to the divine. So minister's quotes could be Christian or Jewish or Buddhist or Indigenous American, Healing Light Center Church, Reverend Rosalind Bruyere.
Mm-hmm.
And we honor... Yeah, I did.
Yeah, she's excellent.
Yes.
Yes.
And she's a wonderful shamanic presence and inspiration and world-level teacher.
Right.
And if there are many spiritual practices, and I encourage people to find the spiritual practice with which they are at home, not necessarily the one they grew up with.
Right. And, you know, in some ways, I was having a laugh with someone last the other day when he was telling me that he'd been a seeker when he was in his adolescence. That, you know, the God of the, you know, the wise old man and the throne in heaven didn't quite do it. And I says, religious educators have really done us a disservice by, you know, teaching kids in the first, second, and third grade that God is this, you know, omniscient parent. And because by the time we become adults, we know our parents weren't omniscient. And therefore, that one up in heaven probably ain't either, you know. So, you know, so we go looking for a different, more adult image of the divine. And again, divine may not necessarily mean that you even believe in God. Divine means that you believe that there's something good to be found somewhere.
Yes, and you know what? I sense really that any traumatic event, whether it be cancer or some other event, that can be a wake-up call to another level.
To finding a deeper
yourself
good.
And finding deeper
meaning. Deeper good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what happened with me. I'm a cancer survivor, too. And it's after that thyroid cancer was taken out, I set on my spiritual path. And it's interesting you mentioned, Pooja, about Rosalind Breyer, because I like what her definition... She says that every illness has a spiritual component, has a psychological component to it. And when I read what you said about cancer, it hit home. And it's someone who is dying to have a feeling connection to the divine. They may be very religious, very spiritual, very moral, but they just don't feel the connection. And when I look back over my life prior to getting that cancer taken out, I was very devoted. But I did not have a feeling connection with God. And now I've gotten it through the shamanic work, through the spirituality.
And by a feeling connection, you mean it's a two-way street rather than a one-way street?
Yeah, it's not. I'm not just talking to God and praying. Meditation started it. Shamanic journey really cemented it in with being connected to the angels, the gods, and walking into that realm, you just feel like you're 99.5% perfect. And then they say, okay, we need to tweak this a little bit. And we need to tweak that a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And we are. We are perfect at the soul level. It's just all these barnacles on us. And that's kind of what I do with spiritual healing, is help to take off those barnacles so that you as a soul can navigate your ship more easily. More like you need to do it.
Yeah, we can win the Preakness or whatever it is that one wins with whatever that sailing ship award is.
Yeah.
We don't have any barnacles on our hull.
Yeah.
But the let's address the issue of angels, since you mentioned your angel Michael, and I'm sure some of us have heard of Angel Michael before. But in your practice and your understanding, who is Michael? Who is this angel?
He's an archangel. He is probably the level of angels that we would say Jesus or Buddha was to humans. Angels are a separate evolution from the human. I know we'd say someone is an angel. Well, they're acting like an angel. And if you get into the metaphysics of it, maybe there wasn't. A person was an angel, and then they decided to come into the human kingdom. But that's not neither here nor there.
All right.
But Archangel Michael is one that is here to help anybody in need. It's a guardian. He has always shown as a knife, and he can transmute or send away anything that should not be there. Basically, he's a guardian.
And so for you, classic mythology of angels, they were sort of created in the first the first yawnings of creation,
the first wave,
and they were there basically to say to God that God's God. God is God, whatever the creative force is, whatever the origin, the pre-origin of the creative forces, the first, yawning here is this profile. And of course, you're saying an archangel, so you're sort of saying that in some ways this is the prototype for all the other angels. In other words, it's
possibly
sort of like a leader in that sense.
Yeah.
But when we talk about archetypes, and if you might see the angel, the archangel, is being an archetype for all the other angels, so that the so-called guardian angels, the other kind of angels, they all work by what legion they belong to. What, you know, and of course, the classic archangels are Gabriel, who is known in Christian, Jewish, and Muslim theologies. Mm-hmm. And you know, angels are, and of course, the classic meaning of angel is messenger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, you know. And the thing is that, you know, like you were saying, that we don't have an angel called Cancer. You know, but it is a message.
Yes, it's a message.
You know?
And my sense is that people, when they're vulnerable, reach out for help. And we can reach out for our personal support, but we can reach out for spiritual support. Mm-hmm. So many spiritual traditions have the helpers or messengers that you can, saints, angels that we can call on. Other people might call on taking a meditation card for the day and a message from one of the many tarot cards, for example.
Yes.
So that there's a whole range of ways we can draw help to go deeper.
I want to continue with this help message in a second, but I just thought you gave me a great plug there for our speaker next week. It's going to be Marie White. Marie White is an internationally known tarot artist and tarot interpreter, and we're going to be sitting around talking about the meaning of the tarot cards as archetypes and reading tarot as a form of meditation for the self journey. You know,
wonderful.
But that'll be next week. Marie White, and her website, by the way, is Mary-L.com, and if you go there, you can see many of her tarot cards that she's painted. It's a rather unique deck artistically, and everybody's waiting for it to be actually published as little cards so that we can use it to read from.
Do you have a website, Mary Phyllis?
Yes, my website is soulshaman.com, soulshaman.com.
And how about you, Pooja? You must have a website. Everybody has a website.
Right. For this book in particular, it's aftershockfromcancer.com. Mm-hmm. I also have one for my other work, which is to do with helping people get grounded so that they can take off with their wings in transitions and change. Yep. And that's roots, the letter N, wings.com.
Yeah.
Rootsn.com.
Roots N, wings.
Wings. Rootsnwings.com. Okay.
But aftershockfromcancer.com is the one that's got all the information about the healing and the book and from cancer. Yeah. And its principles are the same, I may say, and I've been told many times, for any illness.
Yeah.
The stories are about cancer, and the stories also help you see that your journey is unique because there are stories of many people that have made many different choices. Yes. As you were saying, the soul is unique.
Yes.
Each of our journeys is unique.
And you mentioned, Paul, about angels being messengers, but they can be messengers for healing. They can be messengers to give us more energy. You might say they step it down. God is the head honcho, so to speak, then the archangels underneath them, and then the angels, they are the deliverers of the energy. They're deliverers of perhaps our spirituality. There's one for spirituality. There may be one for our career, maybe one for our relationships. And in different ways, they can help.
And in terms of a message is something that you get, or you can be challenged with. You don't necessarily, when you get a message, it doesn't necessarily mean you understand it,
right.
or you hear it, or you're receptive to it.
Right.
But you're there. It gets to you.
Yeah,
far away.
I had a conversation with my body as a way of getting a message, and I thought, I'm not sure what it was going to say, but it had a lot to say about. You know, me not taking time for myself, and
yes.
that my weak link in my genetic chain is osteoporosis in my family. And here I was having calcifications in my breast where it's not needed, where I really needed strong bones.
Yes.
It was
So there's all sorts of messages. And sometimes people can go out for a walk and feel they get a message from a feather that or a bird that flies. Yes. You know, there's many ways shamanically.
And this does raise a theme that we'll be talking about many times and in various from various intersections on this show, which is the nature of the imagination. The imagination here is our friend. And normally, imagination is not just make-believe. Imagination is where we, where poetry, it's where poetry lives for us. Mm-hmm. It's where love takes off. It's where many of our aspects of our life in terms of the way we make meaning, the way things are important to us are because we have this imaginative ability. Part of the imaginative ability is to interweave our sense impressions into some kind of sense, and this goes on. But there's another aspect of imagination, which is this deeper angelic aspect. And the angelic aspect is one aspect of this imaginative sense, that it represents a way of communing with the mysteries of our life. And we can both derive consolation from the development of this, and the imagination is very versatile. For instance, actively imagining when I was going through something, I remember very much having conversations with my body. I said, "Okay, body, what's going on?" And my body would say, "Blah blah 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 blah." I said, "Well, I knew that. I didn't want to hear any more about it. Why don't you just get used to me ignoring you?" But my arguments with my imaginative arguments with my body are not necessarily things that I need to get on the radio about. This form of active imagination is part of this soul retrieval aspect. In some ways, it's through the imagination and that the imagination is liberated in a way, and that parts of yourself are restored. This is an imaginative exercise.
I like to see the imagination as being a realm, just as much as the mind is a realm. The emotions are a realm. If somebody says, "Oh, it's just your imagination," they're saying it's false, but that's not so. This is where musicians bring up new music, new songs. Artists get the idea of new art. And when I go into the shamanic journey, we call it journey because we feel like we're moving somewhere. I feel like I go into that realm, and it's in that realm that I meet with the angels, I meet with the souls, and I bring them back. And it has happened so. I've done over 1,000 soul retrievals by now, and always there's something that comes back. The person may not recognize it at first, but as we work later on the integration or the transformation that I like to call it, because it does transform you when you go clear through with the whole integration process, they recognize there's something there. There's something that came back. And sometimes it's so innate they didn't even realize it. One person was afraid to speak up in groups, and about a month after she had a soul retrieval, she was in a group of 15 people. It used to be she would only talk if there were no more than four, but 15, she disagreed with somebody, she got up out of her chair, went up to the front of the room, described her point of view, drew a diagram on the board and described that, took a couple of questions and sat back down again, and then she said, "Whoa, I never used to would have done that," you know. So sometimes it's very innate that way. But the imagination is really an important part of all healing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think one way that the imagination, the body doesn't know the difference between real and imagined. So yes. I think one way that it has become more understood is through guided imagery.
Yeah.
And the very image specific or even energetic imagery. And people can really do very well with giving the body a positive message.
Yeah, I remember one of the laws I learned in affirmations is that the unconscious doesn't understand not. So if I say, "I don't want to be poor," I don't want to be poor. What the unconscious hears is, you want to be poor. You want to be poor. So what you say instead is, I want to be rich. I want to be rich. I am rich. I am filthy rich. And that may not pay your creditors, but you might feel good about yourself.
Yeah, I think the powerful words are I can, I choose, because even I want to has a lack in it.
Yes,
want,
that's a good point.
Know, so
yes.
I choose, I can, I have, I love.
Yes.
Yes. And this actually does cycle back onto one thing that's been implicit in what we've been talking about in the last few minutes, which is prayer. You know, so the question is I could see praying through an angel. But normally, at least in my version of mysticism, I always pray to the divine. See? And the way I would say, if I pray through an angel for me in this particular case would be like an attitude or feeling or a sense of presence that I might have that would be divine or lustrous in some ways. But I'd always take that and always pray to the divine.
It sounds like you're using your own angelic guides and asking them to send the prayer up to God.
Yeah, to the degree that the angelic guides are... this sense of presence that I might have, that the divine presence I might have a sense of, could be the angelic, could be understood as an angelic God.
Some people might find that presence in nature.
Yes,
I think there are all many, many different ways. We're all different, and so to practice the presence of God, that might not have anything for them to do with the word God, but it can be that connection with the universal whole, the beauty, the replenishment that comes from Mother Earth.
Yes, and also nature, and also be in things such as family. It could be it can be in the satisfaction that one has in one's crafts, in the accomplishments of one's deeds during a day, and just the ability to appreciate things to say, I may be feeling terrible, but I can see that such and such is beautiful.
I think our experience of the divine can often evolve over time, because I was certainly brought up with a male God and, moved from that to understand the divine feminine and then to the divine presence within.
Yes.
And so...
Yeah. Yeah, actually, years ago, back in the 70s, I guess that was a while ago, when I was first encountered the rise of Wicca, and the first Wiccans I met were all lesbians, right? I don't want to deal with no male guys. What the heck, I can understand that. But then I said this divine feminine thing, I found it was a challenge for me. I feel sort of intimidated by it. This was my definite feeling at the time. So therefore, it's something I must get to know. So I consciously went off and joined a Wiccan coven and got initiated. And I went for actually 7 years. It was literally 7 years. 7 years later, I had a spontaneous vision of the goddess, which is another story. And we don't have time to deal with that kind of stuff today. But what I did do is I was able to deal with a sense of lack, and I think that in our time, in the last decades, if not the last century or two, the emergence of the divine feminine, the feminine image of the divine as the world that we live on, as this blessed emerald green planet, and its life, its vicarious life, this little biosphere, which is so thin and sacred that we live within, and unfortunately we still act it and take it for granted, is an extremely important move theologically. Carl Jung recognized that when he said that the Assumption of the Virgin Mary that was done in 1875 or 1850 or sometime like that in terms of the Catholic Church was a major move in this recognition of the divine feminine, and I think the most recent thing of that, the Da Vinci Code, where this not very good novel suddenly had incredible theological implications for people. Why? Because it was trying to bring in a conscious, noble, feminine image into the Christian mythos. You know, it wasn't just a bunch of men hanging out together, you know, that there were women there, you know, and it's very well attested in the New Testament documents in the early Christianity that Mary Magdalene was one of the first disciples of Jesus. And it was sort of written out by a bunch of men who took over the church. In fact, one of the strongest early churches in Christianity was men and women served equally, you know. And of course, 200 or 300 years later, when the church began to ape the administrative aspects of the Roman Imperium, that this all, of course, was written out, you know. But again, the other thing about the Bible in terms of the images of women is that one of the things they know archaeologically is that the Jews during biblical times and Old Testament times, that when they do the household things, they always find household gods of Astarte, the goddess, in all these Jewish homes. So what happened is that the Bible as we have it was pretty much a book written by men, with one or two exceptions, for men, and the goddess was written out of the Bible at a very early age and somewhat systematically. But so it's really healthy, this the finding the divine feminine. This is for not only for women to find the divine feminine for themselves, but also for men to recognize the divine feminine within themselves, I think is a really important psychological invitation to wholeness.
The balance of wholeness, yes.
Yeah.
And I think this is where the imagination comes in.
Yeah.
Because that is very, in many ways, considered feminine. For a while, in schools, only the girls went out for chorus. Only the girls took art. And now it's coming around. The men realize they can have that imagination in there and still be the full man. So this is where the imagination is so very important, and going inward in many ways.
Yeah, thanks. Well, we're actually coming up to the end of our hour here. I want to reintroduce our guests in case you didn't join us at the very beginning. We've had Pooja Thompson, and tell us about your book again and where people might be able to find it.
My book is Aftershock, From Cancer Diagnosis to Healing. It's a step-by-step guide to help you navigate your way, and it's available in local bookstores if you ask them. You can also get it online, or you can get it from aftershockfromcancer.com.
And Mary Phyllis Horn, who we will have back probably after the first of next year, to discuss in more detail the shamanistic soul work that she does and the soul retrieval work that she does. So we'll be able to pick her brain some more and give her another hard time about the nature of soul.
Okay.
Yeah. So Mary Phyllis, again, say what your website is.
My website is soulshaman.com, soulshaman.com. Yeah. And you can contact me through that, through the email as well.
Through that.
Yeah, and if you have an area phone book, I'm in Pittsburgh, so just I'm in the book.
You're in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Mary Phyllis and I know each other through studying in an Edgar Cayce
Search for God
group, uh-huh, which has been very active in this area.
Yeah.
And one of these days, I'm going to have somebody come down from the Edgar Cayce group to tell us what they're doing. So I want to let you know that this has been Touchstones. My name is Paul Nodge. This is a regular weekly feature in which we discuss personal religious experience, and also within the Chapel Hill Carborough context. This is WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carborough. You are listening to WCOM, and we are at 103.5 FM, and you can find us at www.communityradio.coop. Thank you so much for being here and joining us here today at this show. And tune in next week at 11 a.m. to listen to myself and Marie White talk about the nature of tarot.